Hey folks, Scott Weingart here. Here's the deal. I wrote an article in the Journal of Emergency Medicine on pre-oxygenation, reoxygenation, and delayed sequence intubation. And two anesthetists from the UK wrote a letter in response to the editor. Now, the traditional way of handling things would have been to write a reply that's kind of snarky, and I hate that. I just hate that. So instead, I figured I'd actually reach out and talk to these folks and hear their viewpoints. So what I did is I got Dr. Stuart Gill on the line. He is a senior anesthetic registrar from the UK, and I think you're going to enjoy this. All right. So I figured the traditional manner of just you guys sending in a letter and me responding, it's fairly useless. We never have any actual conversation. We don't get to talk out our viewpoints on stuff. And I think it's very old school. And we're in a new generation. And I think there's no reason for folks not to have the opportunity to actually talk about their questions about an article rather than just writing back and forth. So hence my desire to contact you folks.
No problem.
All right. So I just want to go through the points in the letter and hear your idea, and maybe I'll tell you my viewpoints, and maybe we'll come to a meeting of the minds here.
Sure.
All right. So the first thing you two wrote is that SpO2 is not a measure of pre-oxygenation. That the best measure of this in clinical practice is the end-tidal oxygen, and you want to achieve greater than 90% end-tidal oxygen. And even in the presence of shunt or reduced lung volume, the increased alveolar partial pressure oxygen will oxygenate the blood after induction, albeit for not as long as a patient in shunt.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Now, I could consider this when I saw it from a number of perspectives, but let's give you guys the idealized situation for, I think, your point of view, and which I imagine would be a toddler who aspirated some foreign object, let's say a small ball, into one of their branch bronchi. And because then you'd have a patient with shunt, but the rest of their lungs would be ideal.
Sure. Okay.
All right. So in that circumstance, you'd have a high partial pressure of oxygen in the good alveoli that are being oxygenated, and you'd have a portion of physiological shunt that would be admixture at the arterial side.
Yeah.
Am I we're on the same page at that point?
Yeah.
All right. So your point would be that the good alveoli, that would still be a pretty significant reservoir of highly oxygenated or highly a good partial pressure of oxygen in that area. And it would just be the loss of a good oxygen sap because of the shunted portions.
Yeah, okay.
All right. Now, I'm with you on that. You'd lose some portion of your lungs, some portion of your reservoir to that shunted area. So you'd certainly have less of a time before desaturation. But what should happen is that you should maintain the same pulse ox you have at the beginning for quite some time until you finally exhausted the reservoir.
Yeah, okay.
Now, the problem with that is it ignores one thing, which is that if you do start losing the partial pressure in the good alveoli, at some point, you're going to lower the saturation on your venous side. Would you grant me that?
Yeah.
As soon as that happens, the admixture is no longer with what would be a normal mixed venous oxygen, which would be around 70%.
Yeah.
But so, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah. So you're going to desaturate much quicker then.
Exactly. So basically, you're at a precipice. The second that the good alveoli start getting below a partial pressure of, let's say, 60 millimeters of mercury, then you're going to get a precipitous drop.
I work in kilopascals.
Oh, okay. We're on totally different units, but essentially there is some area where the sat is around that 90% mark that you're going to start getting not just desaturation of the good alveoli, but the admixture is going to be at a much worse situation because the venous side coming in is no longer at around 70 or 60. It's lower. At that point, the patients drop like a stone.
Yeah.
But that's in the idealized circumstance of a patient with perfect alveoli outside of the shunted area, that ball in a bronchi, or a bronchus. What about the patient who's actually critically ill and has more homogeneously bad alveoli? Well, now that precipice point is going to be much, much sooner.
Because you've got far less oxygen exchange, haven't you?
Yep.
That's certainly more realistic, isn't it? The kid with the completely blocked bron- because you're not going to be able to do anything about it anyway.
Correct.
It's absolutely broke block. So yeah, okay.
Now, what if you grant me that I could diminish the fraction of the lungs that are shunted? Well, now I'm going to be doing two things. I'm going to be increasing the reservoir because I'll have more alveoli with a functional residual capacity. But perhaps more importantly, I'm going to decrease the amount of admixture and decrease that really horrible situation of the poorly oxygenated mixed venous blood mixing with the arterial.
Yeah, I agree with you completely. And I think our point there often things can be misconstrued in the reading. And I think partly that's how we've read your paper and partly how you've read that point. I think we were just saying that S saturation purely as a measure of pre-oxygenation isn't sufficient to say that you've adequately pre-oxygenated a patient.
Oh, absolutely. And I think the converse is true as well, which is a high end tidal oxygen is necessary but not sufficient either.
Yeah, sure.
But I would go one step further and say for most of us, and this all came out of the anesthesia literature, we're not even using end-tidal oxygen because it doesn't tell us what we want to know. It'll tell us if we've taken all the good alveoli and given them maximal denitrogenation, but it won't tell us if we've achieved tissue maximal oxygenation or blood maximal oxygenation.
No, sure. I think it's only really used in fit and healthy patients.
Sure.
Or routine operations, and I'll give you that, no problem.
But I would say that even after you achieve that 90% end tidal, you probably should continue for the 3 minutes of tidal volume breathing, or at least the 8 vital capacity breaths, to maximize your reservoir throughout all body compartments.
Sure.
So that's why we have a mass spectrometer in my resuscitation bay that will measure both end tidal CO2 and oxygen, but we don't bother because we just mandate that the patient gets at least 3 minutes at high FiO2.
Okay.
Just clinically, just to make the point on the podcast, I think you and I are actually on the same page, but just to make the point, there's been 5 studies in the anesthesia literature, 1 in the ICU literature, showing a dramatic decrease or increase in the time to critical desaturation when CPAP is used in patients who have already been maximally pre-oxygenated with pure oxygen. So that would be the clinically important evidence showing that you actually can increase the time to desaturation by eliminating shunt with CPAP. And that was 4 of those studies were in the morbidly obese, and then 1 of them was in normal weight patients going into elective operations. And then 1, perhaps most relevant, was ICU patients.
That was the Bayard.
Yep. Precisely. So there, and then just to go along with the point that maybe we should be looking at oxygen saturation as a marker of adequate pre-oxygenation is a study by Davis with all the paramedic literature out of San Diego, and he showed the most important predictor of the rapidity of decline of the pulse ox during the apneic period is the initial pulse ox, which I think ties in very nicely to what you and I have been discussing, which is once you get down to around that 90% mark and you have a shunted patient, the admixture is going to be deadly.
So you say that the initial pulse ox being before you've attempted any pre-oxygenation.
Right before you intubate.
Right, so after you've performed your pre-oxygenation maneuvers.
And that's intuitively, that makes sense to anyone who manages airway like you and I, because if you start off low, you're already on that portion of Benyamov's reworking of Farmery's data, you know, the Benyamov charts that show how long you have before that 90% saturation.
Sure.
If you look at where you are, if you start at 90, in every patient group, you have less than 60 seconds before you get to that critical point of 70% saturation.
Yeah.
All right, so I think we're on the same page, and it's really just making sure that people are very clear on both points. You need both the maximal denitrogenation, but if you can achieve a diminishment of the shunt, the physiologic shunt, that's probably beneficial.
Yeah, I agree completely with that. That's not a problem.
All right. So then the next point you guys made is patients who are combative due to hypoxia or hypercapnia often will not comply with non-invasive ventilation, and it may not be appropriate as a pre-oxygenation strategy.
Yeah.
So why don't you tell me your thoughts on that?
I think just purely by personal experience, those patients who you would deem appropriate for non-invasive ventilation purely on clinical grounds, based on gases, what have you, sort of your COPD patients. Those that are significantly combative or have a certain amount of delirium, they are extremely difficult to keep on NIV for sufficient time for it to be of benefit. That's purely personal experience. And the vast majority of those patients, we found that you end up progressing on to intubate. Now, that's not to say that it's not a valid thing to try. And I think this is probably where there's a bit of crossover in our opinions on it. In that if, based on the clinical picture, how fatigued the patient looks, how their gases are looking, if you were going to try NIV, or if you think NIV is appropriate based on that, then I'd certainly give it a go, but I'd have a relatively low threshold then to proceed to intubate them if they weren't tolerating the mask.
We're in absolute agreement. But one of the things that article discussed in particular is a strategy to deal with the patients who require NIV, not to avoid intubation, simply to pre-oxygenate for a planned intubation. And that would be what in the article we called delayed sequence intubation.
With the ketamine.
Exactly. And that's my take on what to do on the exact patient you described, the delirious patient who needs to be intubated but hasn't achieved 100% saturation or close to it, what I'd like to see to feel maximally safe performing intubation. And ketamine, in both our anecdotal experience and now we actually have an abstract, gives you ideal situation to put the patient on non-invasive.
Okay. I mean, that sort of leads on to our other concern, which was over the dose of ketamine, as quoted in the article. We certainly felt that a dose of 1 to 2 milligrams per kilo, and in our experience, that effectively is an anesthetic dose. And in patients with a pneumonia or an infective exacerbation COPD who may be aseptic as well, I'd have significant concerns about people taking that at face value and going and giving significant doses of ketamine to those patients.
Well, could you elaborate on your concerns?
A dose of 1 to 2 milligrams per kilo of ketamine is an induction dose for anesthesia.
Well, let's be very clear, Stuart. While it is the dose we would use for induction to perform anesthesia, it is not a classic anesthetic.
Okay. Meaning
it is a dissociative agent, not our classic induction agents, which are in the sedative category. The full disassociating dose of ketamine leaves you of a very different situation than a full induction dose of any of the other typical induction agents.
Well, I got to say, having spoken to quite a few colleagues who use ketamine in both hospital and pre-hospitally, both as an analgesic, as a dissociative sedative, and as an induction for RSI, and there is a fairly fine line that you can cross over into anesthesia and even apnea. I know it does cause far less respiratory depression than the other anesthetic agents, but there still is a risk of causing apnea and effectively full anesthesia with it.
Well, that would be in contradiction to all of the extant literature. In fact, the largest systematic review in adult patients, and I have no experience nor would I ever feel qualified to talk about pediatric patients, but the largest experience in adult patients was a systematic review done by one of my colleagues, Ruben Strayer, and there's really no incidence of apnea from any dose of ketamine, even far into the overdose. If you push ketamine rapidly, there will be a period of between 15 and 30 seconds of apnea. But beyond that, the patient will continue to spontaneously breathe. And that's thousands of patients, most of them coming out of the third world literature where there is no anesthetist and no one monitoring the patient's airway. And the respiratory depression does not exist. In fact, it actually uprevs the patient's respiratory drive at the respiratory center in the medulla. And perhaps more importantly in this circumstance, they don't lose their airway reflexes either. And that's far, far out of the standard dissociative range. We could give 4 mg/kg. The patient will still be breathing. Even if you double or triple the dose you're used to in ketamine, the patient's still breathing. And I'd be really intrigued to see anything to the contrary that's been published.
Okay, that's fair enough. And I can't quote you anything. All I can say is personal experience and conversations with colleagues that ketamine use in the UK certainly is re-emerging, if you like. And there's been a certain amount of caution given about using it too liberally. And that may be, as you say, giving it in a push does cause maybe a short period of apnea. But in the patients we're talking about who are on a bit of a knife edge, that could tip them over into significant desaturation anyway.
Well, let me put it to you this way, and you tell me if it's a rational proposal. When I'm talking about the delayed sequence intubation, and I make this very clear to folks, it's not with the idea that you push it, you put the patient on non-invasive, and you go see a few other patients in the ED. You're fully prepped for rapid sequence induction. You have all of your additional meds, including your paralytics, all of your airway equipment, and your difficult airway equipment. If the patient was to go apneic beyond a few seconds, which shouldn't happen if pushed at the proper response, you would proceed with the same RSI that you and Dr. Campbell are proposing, and you really wouldn't have lost anything by the attempt to see if now the patient will tolerate for a brief period of time non-invasive, not to avoid intubation, but solely for the purpose of pre-oxygenation.
With that caveat, it is, I would say, a safer approach.
All right, fair
enough. And that's maybe, again, to some degree, a misreading of your article.
Well, that is what the article really went into, but unfortunately, because they constrain your words, it's this exact circumstance, and that's why I love that you folks wrote the letter that allows clarification. So it's wonderful that you will have this opportunity to put in the literature what I think you are saying is a better expression of this, so that people don't do the wrong thing.
Okay. I've just found the portion of the article just to refresh myself.
Yeah,
it says a dose of 1 to 1.5 mg/kg by slow intravenous push, so that's fair enough, will produce a calmed patient. Now, I think it was probably just the fact it said a push. I when I give it for as a sedative, I'd say I'd give it in 10 to 20 milligram per kilo increments, and that probably equates to what you call a slow intravenous push.
Sure. Though I will say, we use this extensively for adult procedural sedation. And there is a point on the ketamine dose curve where you're beyond the analgesic doses, so beyond the 20 milligrams, but you haven't fully disassociated the patient, where they actually get a dramatic increase in agitation at times. This state where they're sub-disassociative. And so they're getting the ketamine's hallucination without really getting enough, puts them into sometimes a very agitated, difficult state that I like to avoid in the critically ill patients. We always, when we're teaching our registrars, tell them that ketamine needs to be given to the point where the patient hits that disassociation. And at that point, it doesn't really matter if you gave more. They don't get really deeper than they would. But until you get there, it's kind of a risky proposition in a critically ill patient.
Okay. I would say personal experience, I'd be happy to be a bit cautious and get through that short period of increased agitation with further boluses.
Sure.
But I see what you're saying.
Yeah, no, with a procedurally sedated patient, I think that's very valid. So now we get to the point of apneic oxygenation. And so let me actually read the piece point here. So further to these concerns, we do not entirely understand the statement regarding minute ventilation in the reoxygenation section. The authors state that in order to provide high levels of oxygenation, all that is required is an FiO2 of 50%, or FiO2 is 0.5, is a minute ventilation of approximately 500 cc's or mls per minute. This would be the provide the minimum quoted oxygen requirement for basal metabolic function, but will not provide high levels of oxygenation, and oxygen requirement in critically ill patients is likely to exceed this figure. So what do you folks mean by that, Dr. Gill?
It was just the fact that it suggests that all you need to provide is an NFiO2 of 0.5. So effectively, what you're saying is 250 mils per minute of oxygen to provide high levels of oxygenation. I thought that didn't quite state the situation in a critically ill patient. Their oxygen requirement is likely to be significantly increased.
By increased metabolism?
Increased metabolic rate due to sepsis.
Sure. So there's a few things inherent in that. And I hope this wasn't confusing in the article. And if it is, hopefully I'll clarify in the letter. I'm not in any way advocating to use an FiO2 of 50%. It's just that's where this data came from.
Theoretical basis.
Right. Well, yeah. West actually did some animal studies on this as well to bear it out. But by all means, give 100%. And by all means, don't give that minimum. But that is probably all you need, is an FiO2 of 50% or greater, and then 250 cc's at the alveolar level, which we double for the dead space requirements to 500, to provide the oxygenation necessary to keep you 100% sat at the alveolar level. Now, the increased metabolic rate of a critically ill patient is somewhat ameliorated by the fact that this is a paralyzed, sedated patient. And while they might have a slight uptick of their DO2, VO2, I don't think it's going to be significant in that 60 to 120 seconds that the patient is both paralyzed and sedated.
Okay, but then you're assuming that you've corrected the shunt completely.
Without a doubt.
That you've got no venous admixture.
Well, absolutely. But the point is, and I hope to clarify this as well, is that giving additional breaths doesn't make that any better. That 500 cc's getting into the alveoli is pretty much the best you're going to do. Not that that will provide ideal oxygen in every patient for the shunt purpose you picked out, but giving 30 breaths will not in any way change that situation.
Okay, but the any ventilation during your induced apnea, you've also got CO2 building up, which is going to, through the alveolar gas equation, reduce your alveolar. So that's why you may want to give ventilation.
They drill this into you, folks, at the beginning of anesthesia, is that once you're at a high FiO2, the CO2 return is negligible in terms of the alveolar gas equation. At room air, it has a significant effect and has no effect at all at high FiO2 levels. It's blown out of the equation entirely. As soon as you achieve anything above a 30% or 0.3 FiO2. And that's pretty clear. The CO2 return takes up a negligible amount of that alveolar space. And in fact, the apneic oxygenation requirement of 250 mLs per minute at the alveolar level is predicated on CO2 return. But during the apneic state, the CO2 return is so small that even at room air, it doesn't significantly affect it. But at an FiO2 of 50% or greater, it's not even in the equation anymore.
Okay. I'm still concerned. There's a lot of factors here. You've got a hypermetabolic patient with sepsis who's got increased CO2 production, increased oxygen requirement, albeit sedated and paralyzed. But I take your point.
Yeah, and I'm no way advocating giving one breath a minute. All for giving the 10 breaths a minute if you're going to reoxygenate a patient. What I wanted to get across is that people believe that more is better, and that if 10 is good, 20 is better, and 30 might be better still. And that's where we lead to gastric insufflation and aspiration.
Yeah, okay.
All right, so now we get to the point. Now, I didn't quite understand this portion of the letter. The article suggests that the use of nasopharyngeal airways, or OPAs, are advanced techniques best performed by experts and may be dangerous in the hands of novices. Now, I hope I didn't in any way state that, and I don't think I did, so I wanted to hear from you folks what that really meant.
Let me find it, because I have just reread it today. So start of the reoxygenation section. If the first pass at intubation fails and the patient's oxygenation saturation drops below 90 to 95%, reoxygenation is required before further intubation attempts. I'd absolutely agree with that. And I think quite often in junior hands, people persist, or even non-junior hands, people persist with attempts at intubation to the sort of detriment of the patient. But it then goes on to say, skilled practitioners will also place an oropharyngeal airway, and if there is any difficulty, nasopharyngeal airways as well. Even in skilled hands, this method can be problematic. When performed by a novice, it can be deadly.
And I was referring to the novice about BVM ventilation, not the placement of airways.
Okay. So,
and it's just as you say, BVM ventilation in the hands of juniors or folks that aren't experienced, obviously, it leads to very bad circumstance. If they're giving too many breaths or giving poor technique, they're not maintaining a good patent airway, that's where you get a patient who's vomiting.
I'd have to dispute that to some degree. You know, all our providers of ALS in hospital are taught the use of BVM as a bimanual two-person technique. And they're all taught the insertion of oropharyngeal and nasopharyngeal airways to augment that. I know supraglottic airway devices are coming to the fore and probably are going to be taken up as part of the primary ALS response patients. But I'd say calling the use of the BVM and use of simple airway adjunct dangerous. That's probably what I've got the greatest concern about.
Well, dangerous in the hands of a novice was, I believe, the statement. Now, the interesting thing about that is in the hands of skilled practitioners, which in our in the States, we would put paramedics in that circumstance, and we put respiratory therapists as well, when they've actually done studies of the respiratory rate achieved during a peri-intubation, those respiratory rates range between 30, 100, 120, and these are skilled practitioners. And I think you and I would both agree that that's not a safe circumstance.
Yeah, I would. And certainly personal experience of attending arrest calls and seeing people bagging, they probably are being a bit vigorous. But I wouldn't say that's all. And I suppose it also depends what you define as a novice. And to my mind, it's someone relatively new to an acute specialty, whereas the person you're describing to me is someone who's virtually never had one in the hand at all, whereas I'm thinking of someone relatively early in their career who's had a reasonable amount of training.
I could tell you, our first year emergency residents, I am very leery of putting a BVM in their hands.
Okay.
Because it's a skill. I would argue it's a skill that needs the same knowledge curve as the more traditionally considered advanced skills. To perform good mask ventilation, it requires training and experience. And you know that when the medical students rotate in your operating theater, correct?
Yeah, and that's one of the skills that we do try to get them to learn, at least iron out some of the worst parts of their technique anyway.
Absolutely.
Because it's a piece of equipment that's available on any ward, and it is potentially life-saving. But like you say, it is something that is relatively difficult to become good at. I think, having said that, I think in the context of a paper talking about the administration of anesthesia, drug-assisted intubation, I think it just sits a little bit wrong. To my mind, I was reading the paper assuming those that are going to perform any of this are already skilled in these techniques. And it just sat wrong that it was in a paper talking about intubation and then stating that use of simple airway adjuncts and a bag valve mask.
I do, to an extent. I'm going to continue to maintain that if we had a device that mandated the number of breaths, the tidal volume, and the rapidity with which that breath is delivered, in even the hands of a moderately experienced practitioner, it would be a safer circumstance.
Okay, yeah, you remove human fallibility, fine, yes.
And especially being that we know from the military studies that when your own epinephrine is surging, your time perception gets very, very skewed. And what you think is 10 breaths a minute is actually 60, and you no longer have any internal perception of that.
Yeah, absolutely. But then the use of end-tidal CO2 monitoring to give you a respiratory rate, and the and I suppose we could talk about CPR as well in the same way. Quality CPR is relatively difficult to get, and that's why various devices have come out to assist it, isn't it?
Absolutely.
So I think an appreciation of the fact that just doing what you think is right, you need to have a parameter to remind you, such as a monitor telling you what respiratory rate you're giving or what depth and rate of compressions you're giving, is valuable.
I agree wholeheartedly.
Fine.
So I think at the end of this, and I imagine this was going to be the case, we're probably on the same page.
Very much in general. I think there's one point we haven't really...
Oh, yeah, please.
We haven't made clear is the distinction between the use of a machine, a non-invasive ventilation machine, and an anesthetic circuit or a back valve mask.
Okay.
For pre-oxygenation. Now, we agree completely on attempts to reduce physiological shunt before performing an induction and intubation. And the Bayard paper certainly does show that you get better reduction in shunt, better oxygenation than traditional pre-oxygenation. Yeah?
Absolutely.
Now, and having looked at the MCRIT site, you do talk about this a little bit, but in the UK or in our practice, we generally would use a water circuit or a Mapleson C to provide CPR manually.
Absolutely.
For inducing a patient in the ED. And that's probably in part due to a lack of availability of ventilators. But what I'd say about the Bayard paper is that they seem to get significant improvement in oxygenation of those patients who were put on NIV for pre-oxygenation as compared to standard pre-oxygenation. Now, it doesn't seem to make clear whether they used PEEP. I don't know if I've missed that in the paper. Do you?
I could pull that up right now. I actually have it in one of my lectures. So you keep going and I'll tell you in a second.
Okay. So I think from what the Bayard paper shows, significant improvement in oxygenation with the use of NIV, and the numbers that they quote almost suggested to me that maybe those patients could have stayed on the NIV. They don't give a proportion of patients that were failed on NIV and then intubated. So I'd be interested to see that.
Sure.
I'd also maintain that good spontaneous assisted CPAP manually is still a valid technique. I wouldn't like to say whether or not NIV is definitely superior. It's certainly going to be better at diminishing shunt. But in the patient who you absolutely need to intubate, is it really that much more beneficial to put them on an NIV machine?
In the article, as opposed to the Mapleson C circuits, what we have in the States is a PEEP valve that fits on the BVM.
Right, okay.
And generates expiratory PEEP. And I absolutely put that out as an option. Now, the interesting thing about that, and I believe, and you tell me if I'm wrong, the Mapleson C, is they're both low-flow CPAP devices.
Mapleson C is more or less the same as a BVM. You use 15 liters a minute. It has an adjustable pressure limiting valve and a collapsible bag, so it's dependent on oxygen flow.
My question, though, is on the Mapleson C, is the patient getting continuous flow if you're not squeezing and they're not breathing?
Yes.
So air is being forced into them. Ooh. Even when they're not taking a breath.
Yeah, there's continuous flow into them.
Into them.
And that will be maintained at the pressure with the pressure limiting valve. So you'll have overspill. We'll also have you'll have CPAP effectively.
Okay, so you see, the Mapleson C then is a markedly more effective device than a BVM with a PEEP valve.
Than a reinflating valve with a PEEP valve.
Exactly, because there's no flow unless you're squeezing, meaning that after the patient expires and breathes out, there's no more PEEP in the circuit. But, and what we've figured out to make it equivalent to a Mapleson C is if you put a nasal cannula at the 15 liters underneath your mask, now it becomes a high flow CPAP device.
Sure, I picked that up actually just before I came on. I saw the blog, the MCRIT bit.
Oh, fantastic!
On that, and yeah, I mean that makes sense. Do people tolerate 15 liters?
Yeah, absolutely. And before I do this on a patient, I made myself and all my registrars do it, and it's fine. It dries out your nose after about 10 minutes, but it's no problem at all. It's not.
But it's only a short term measure, obviously.
Absolutely. So that makes it as good as a Mapleson C. I wish I had Mapleson C circuits. That I think would be the ideal pre-oxygenation technique.
There we are. I think, I think I said one of our emails that possibly some of this will just be different equipment and different practices between our practice and your practice over the Atlantic, maybe.
Absolutely. Now, I wanted to finish off with a question because you folks brought up the NAP4, and that was an article I covered pretty extensively on the blog. What is your experience, if you're able to comment on this, with emergency registrars over there and why they haven't taken on the aegis of being airway managers for most of the UK?
I think it's slowly developing, and there's more and more emergency medicine registrars and new consultants that are managing airway more in the emergency department. And I think it's just as a result of the tradition, the traditional training in AE, as was emergency medicine now. I think they just didn't get extensive training in it.
How does the anesthetist world feel about that? Is it, are they?
I think it's fairly variable. There's a little bit of resistance. And, I think most anesthetists can quote episodes of having to attend A&E to help out where things have gone wrong.
Sure.
But I don't think, as an anesthetist, we do manage more airways than anyone else. I think that's a given.
Sure.
And the frequency of managing airways is obviously going to improve your skills. But having said that, I don't think it removes the fact that other people can manage airways in critical patients. I think one of the key things is recognizing when it's going to be difficult and having a good system in place to get help at short notice.
Absolutely agree. Well, this has been an absolute pleasure. I've really enjoyed this conversation.
Thanks very much. Cheers.
Bye-bye, my friend.